Welcome back to another edition of Behind the Headlines. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. And if you're like me, you've already started to get into the holiday spirit. Well, coming up in today's show, we'll catch up with theater freelancer Mike Fisher about a new holiday play opening this week called Black Nativity. We'll also check in on how Paul Ryan is doing during his first few weeks as Speaker of the House. And basketball writers Charles Gardner and Matt Velasquez give us the lowdown on some of the recent Bucks lineup changes Jason Kidd has made. In our first segment, reporter Brianne Shawso sat down with crime reporter Ashley Lutheran. Ashley has been examining crime in Milwaukee as part of her weekly Precious Lives series. In today's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Ashley tells the story of the financial cost violence can have. Here's Brianne and Ashley with more.
Ashley, this week you tell readers the story of Claudaire Motley. What happened to him?
Claudaire Motley is a native of Milwaukee. He graduated from Milwaukee Tech High School in 1989. He and his wife and their three children have since moved to North Carolina, but he was back in town last summer for a high school reunion. While he was dropping a friend off on 63rd Street near Capitol Drive, he was a victim of an attempted carjacking, but in the process, the suspect, a 15-year-old boy named Nathan King, shot him in the jaw. Claudaire was able to drive to the hospital himself miraculously, came in and just collapsed at St. Joseph's, and they eventually transferred him to Frederick Hospital, which kicked off this series of surgery after surgery after surgery to repair his jaw.
When you tell his story in your piece, you also explore the costs of gun violence. What did you learn about those costs during the course of your reporting?
During the course of my reporting, it becomes very apparent that everything adds up so quickly. Everything has a cost associated, a real cost, whether it's the police officers who come to investigate, whether it's the surgeons who are working on Claudaire's jaw, whether it's all of us, the public, who have to absorb costs from the criminal justice system, from increased insurance premiums, from all of that. It just continues to add. It's sort of like once the shooting happens, this invisible calculator starts running and there's no way to stop it.
How did you get the idea for this story? I mean, did you just start thinking about, you know, wow, there's got to be costs associated with all this? Or is there research being done on this?
There's a lot of research that's tried to put a number to the cost of gun violence in the United States, in Wisconsin, and in the city of Milwaukee. In fact, the Journal Sentinel back in 2006 ran a series about non-fatal gunshot wounds. And they're one of the series focuses then was to look at costs, which was at that point kind of a relatively new idea. This was a way to update that story and tell it through a very personal lens, not just looking at big systemic costs, but the real cost to this one man investigating this one shooting and treating all of his injuries.
To this day, what did you find to be the cost?
The cost related to everything, including his medical care. The suspect was ultimately arrested and convicted. The prison time sentenced, all of that is at least $700,000. And that's a low estimate, I would say, because although, you know, I did my best and I checked with experts in terms of the number of hours that roughly a task would take and the hourly wage for the people performing those tasks, it's still there are so many little things that probably are undercounted in that. And we acknowledge that in the story, the numbers an at least figure. But when you think about $700,000 for one shooting victim and one case, there were 583 people shot and survived in the city of Milwaukee last year alone. It's a huge cost.
What impact do these costs, which, you know, include financial ones, you also talk about social costs in the story, what impact do they have, you know, not only on the victims, but on the perpetrators, on society? What's the impact?
The impact is huge, and economists sort of grapple with how you actually put a monetary number on that. So in this particular story, we don't have a monetary figure attached to it, but we acknowledge those costs, which include families living in fear. Obviously, families who are traumatized by either witnessing violence or hearing about it in their neighborhood, families who move, a lack of investment into neighborhoods that are challenged by violent crime. And so you have this lack of investment. You have property values that in most cases go down. And if people are moving out, you have a lesser tax base. So it's just sort of this spiraling.
And this story is just one of an ongoing project the Journal Sentinel is part of called Precious Lives. What can you tell us about this project?
Precious Lives is a wide-ranging media-led effort to explore the causes and consequences of gun violence on youth. And it's not just looking at the causes and consequences of homicide and non-fatal shootings, but also, you know, we want to explore accidental shootings and suicides. And it really is a project that's led by 371 Productions, which is a local production firm here in Milwaukee. They produce the weekly radio series that then air on WUWM and WNOV. The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism is also a partner in contributed reporting for this Cost of Gun Violence piece.
Ashley, what would you like to add about the piece or about the project?
I think one other thing to add is that this case was unusual in that the teenager who was ultimately convicted of shooting Claude, he himself was shot 2 days after shooting Claudaire. And he was paralyzed. And so his costs also are great. And he was shot by an intended victim of a robbery. And that woman has, we've written about her in other Precious Life stories. We've written about her in other Precious Lives stories, and she's described the emotional impact of her having to make that choice and having, you know, and shooting this 15-year-old. And he is now in a wheelchair. He's going to be in prison for 12 and a half years. He will be on supervision for 7.5 years after that. And so his costs for taking care of him, just as within a state correctional system, are at least $400,000. I mean, that's pretty much 60% of the total cost of this calculation. So that was one thing I found somewhat surprising, in that I knew costs for incarceration were very high. But to put that in perspective on the scale of this, it really shows how costly it is. And to his family, they've also had to deal with a lot of costs, his medical costs, trying to take care of his debts so that his mother hopes when he comes out, she can help him lead a productive, healthy life.
Again, you can find that story in today's paper. It's also available online at jsonline.com/news. In features news, the Black Arts Think Tank was formed last year as a consortium for outlets like the Lansbury Sands Theater Company and the African American Children's Theater. This group is staging Black Nativity by Langston Hughes from December 10th through the 13th at the Marcus Center for Performing Arts. Black Nativity, which was written by Langston Hughes and first staged in 1961, features the first act, which is about the telling of the nativity story, including Mary and Joseph arriving in Bethlehem and the birth of Jesus. This half mainly includes spirituals, while the second act, which fast forwards to a modern-day African-American congregation, uses full-fledged gospels to tell the story. I asked theater writer and reviewer Mike Fisher what was significant about this production.
It's so exciting that it's being done. That's significant in and of itself, and that it's being done through the BATT, the Black Alliance Think Tank, and with some muscle behind it from Marcus as well, and from Paul Matthews, who's the president and CEO of Marcus. And I think that there is a real commitment to making this the part of an annual tradition, so that we would see a Black Nativity every year, the way we see Christmas Carol or Nutcracker or things like that. That's important in terms of it happening. In terms of the particulars of the production, I think that Aziza Islam, who is directing it, has said that she's going to try and be fairly faithful to Langston Hughes' original vision. So you're going to get a sort of straight up, this is the gospel story, these are the songs that Hughes thought about that might go really well with it. And it's just an incredibly, if it's done right, inspiring and uplifting way of thinking about this important moment. One of the things that really impressed me in talking to Aziza Islam, this is somebody who was raised as a Baptist, spent a number of years as a Jehovah's Witness, was then a Lutheran, converted to Islam. Now it sort of does not identify herself specifically with any of those particular denominations or religions. She says, you know, I'm not a Christian in terms of where I am in my life at this point, but I understand and value the importance of this piece for everybody. This is not just a piece for Christians, any more than the Christmas story is necessarily just just for Christians. I mean, the story we have here is about somebody who is born into circumstances where he is very poor, where he is not, you know, seen as important, and where he nevertheless, because of the love that is part of who he is and the community he's a part of, helps to change the world. And tapping into that idea as an idea of somebody who is a poor carpenter's son and nevertheless becomes important to the world is something that I think is really important to her, and also an opportunity to share some of the really wonderful ritual celebration that goes on within the Black churches in Milwaukee, and therefore a chance to share some of Black culture in Milwaukee with the rest of Milwaukee.
And how would you say the Milwaukee theater scene has evolved since you've been covering it?
It's become so much more dynamic and vibrant. I think you have a lot more groups than you had in times past, and so there's just more going on. I mean, for us at the Journal Sentinel, and just in general in town for people who are theater fans, to even keep up with everything that's happening now is harder than ever. I think that's one way it's evolved. Another way in which it's evolved, albeit more slowly, is you see more attention being paid to incorporating different cultural perspectives and also having on stage and involved in design women and people of color to a greater degree than was true in the past. I still think we have a long ways to go, but why should we be any different from anywhere else? This is a challenge that we face as a society, but there's been very exciting progress made in those areas, and that's, I guess, I want to focus during this Christmas season on the glass being half full rather than half empty.
You can find more on this production in today's paper, as well as online at tapmilwaukee.com. And keep an eye out in the coming weeks for a review of this production from Mike Fisher as well. Odds are, if you've gone out in Milwaukee, you've been out on Downer Avenue. I was just there last night. I saw a movie at the Downer Theater and afterward grabbed a quick drink at Cafe Hollander. But to head to Downer Avenue is to see vacant storefront properties dotting the street. Those properties have been bought by a developer, and business reporter Tom Dakin has an updated story about their status.
The story is basically an update for our readers about the Downer Avenue Business District on Milwaukee's east side. There are two buildings there that collectively make up about half the space there, and these are buildings that include the Downer Theater, Boswell Book, Pizza Man, Cafe Hollander, some of the better-known stores and restaurants in that two-block business district. Those properties went into the foreclosure process about a year, 2 years ago. And in September, after the foreclosure auction was concluded, they were sold to the new owner, which is just an investment group out of New York City. And what's happening is that new owner is spending some money on some repairs to the buildings, including a new roof for one of them, and is now actively marketing the vacancies to, you know, other stores and restaurants. The story is basically looking at that process to try and determine, well, what kind of retail businesses will go into those spaces. And also I talked to some of the other store restaurant operators on the street to ask them what they'd like to see there and how those vacancies have affected their businesses over the past several years. Some of those spaces have been vacant for a long time. The Chancery, the Einstein Bagel Shop that closed, that goes back to 2006 and 2007, and that's a really long time for space to remain vacant in what is otherwise a pretty vibrant, affluent area.
And what could other neighborhoods where there are vacant storefront buildings go through a similar process like this, or could they learn anything from this?
Honestly, Downer Avenue is unusual because it has that relatively high number of vacant properties, again, in an area that is pretty affluent. The east side within a mile of there, I think the household median income is north of $42,000, which is pretty good. You have a lot of UWM students who live in the area, but you also have a lot of established families. And the factors that have kept those properties vacant probably have less to do with kind of the surrounding neighborhood and more to do with the previous owner, who for years had hoped to do a redevelopment of that property, a hotel, some new apartment buildings. And I think he was probably not as aggressively pursuing retail tenants as another owner who didn't have those redevelopment plans would otherwise be doing.
And this isn't the only development-related area that you're covering. You're also looking at some of the developments that are happening downtown with the new Bucks Arena. What are some of the trends you've noticed in terms of development in Milwaukee in the past few years?
Well, the hottest product by far that I write about the most in Milwaukee and the surrounding communities are apartments. And a lot of that has to do with a kind of a national trend, a shift of people who are in their 20s and 30s, the so-called millennials, who show a greater interest in living in urban areas than their parents did. And they're also showing less eagerness to actually own their homes in the form of either single-family homes or condominiums than their parents did. So you combine those factors, you get upscale apartments that cater to those people, and to some extent catering to empty nesters, people in say their 50s, 60s who are moving back to urban areas into smaller living spaces. And again, it's an attraction of urban life. People want to be near bars, restaurants, museums, performing arts centers. They want walkable areas to live in. That's not to say that people still don't live in the suburbs, of course, but there is that greater trend now that really has been building for some time.
Tom's story is also appearing in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You can find it online at jsonline.com/business. And you can find more from Tom on Twitter using the Twitter handle @TomDakin. It's only been a few weeks since he has stepped into the role, but how has Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan fared so far as Speaker of the House? Washington Bureau Chief Craig Gilbert sized up Ryan's recent accomplishments during our JS on Politics show on Thursday. Here's Craig and editor Greg Borowski with more.
We're joined now by Craig Gilbert, our Washington Bureau Chief, and we want to talk, Craig, a little bit about Paul Ryan and how he's approaching his job and this speech this morning. So first, can you just give us a sense? He's been in this role for a few weeks now. What's the general assessment in Washington of how he's approaching the job and how he's doing?
Well, he's getting pretty good reviews. I mean, after he's in his second month now, and for a guy who hadn't planned on being speaker and nobody thought would be speaker until pretty recently, he's doing this with some deliberation. He's showing some strategic thinking. He's been kind of very deliberate and calculating about how he communicates. A huge presence in the media. He's negotiated some of these early minefields with flying colors. He got a Syrian refugee bill passed with a quarter of the Democratic caucus. He's passing big legislation on education and transportation this week. He's got a real test coming up on a spending bill to avoid a government shutdown, but he is saying right now, he's expressing a lot of confidence that there will be no government shutdown, and if he can avoid that fate, he'll have succeeded at least with the launch of his speakership.
Right, well, what's the purpose of this speech today, where he's sort of setting out his agenda a little bit and trying to chart a course going forward? What do you think he's hoping to accomplish here?
Well, I think a couple things. I mean, this is happening in the middle of a Republican presidential campaign that is causing a lot of anxiety in his own party. People are very nervous, insiders, about the possibility of a Donald Trump nomination. So I think he's trying to put his stamp on the party's message. He is the most powerful Republican in Washington, and he's trying to lay out a message that I think in some ways may be a counter to Donald Trump. I don't think that's the explicit mission of this speech. But he's also trying to do something that he's talked about for years and years and years, which is kind of position his party as offering a very clear and, as he says, bold alternative to Democrats. He's talked ever since he got the speakership about trying to turn 2016 into a very defining election in which Republicans, if they win, can govern with something like a mandate.
Yeah, he's talked, in recent weeks about not wanting to just be the opposition party. Here's the proposition of what we're going to do. And the things he's highlighting, I mean, can we glean anything from that? I assume we're going to hear about Medicaid and Medicare.
Yeah, you're going to hear about some of the kinds of proposals that we're familiar with from his budgets and his roadmap, which is trimming and overhauling some domestic spending programs, including things that affect the social safety net. He's going to talk about traditional Republican ideas like building up the military, a strong defense. He's going to talk, obviously, in some very broad strokes about what he sees as the difference between the two parties' sort of governing philosophy. So, you know, what he's trying to do is a little bit tricky because on the one hand, he's trying to lay out kind of a bold conservative agenda that can keep, I think that his base can begin to rally around. But at the same time, he's governing in an environment where Republicans can't really get things done legislatively. So his message to Republicans and conservatives is there's a real limit to what we can do under a Democratic president. We need to elect a Republican president. In the meantime, this is what we stand for. Have some patience. We're going to keep the trains running and the lights on. Bear with us until we can get a Republican in the White House.
To find a full replay of that show, visit jsonline.com/politics. You can also subscribe to that show as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. In their weekly podcast on the Milwaukee Bucks, reporter Charles Gardner and Matt Velasquez talked about leadership on the team and some of the reasons for the lineup changes by coach Jason Kidd.
And before the game on Monday against Denver, Kidd mentioned that one of the things about putting those veterans into the starting lineup is those guys, they know how to talk, they know how to communicate on the floor. And that's something that he finds to be, really important, especially for, their spacing and their defense, and just kind of getting that leadership out of them. I mean, you mentioned, Mayo talking to Michael Carter-Williams, after a game, well, he's been doing that, all year, even when he wasn't playing. You would see him on the bench,
yes,
pulling players aside, talking to them, kind of offering encouragement. He's definitely taking that role on more than other guys. So, Bayless has done it too. I haven't seen it as much from him. Not that he hasn't done it, and not that that's not happening behind the scenes, but definitely from what I've seen, OJ's been doing that, and I think that like you said, there's a vacuum there. With Zaza Pachulia gone, Ersan Ilyasova gone, Jared Dudley gone, the Bucks are a young group, and they're looking for leadership and looking for veteran guys to look up to. And Kidd called it a copycat league, and if the veterans are doing one thing, the younger guys are going to follow. And I think that's true, and I've heard that from other people around the league that's the case. So, having the right culture and the right leadership can definitely play a positive or negative role in the way that a team progresses throughout a season.
Oh, no question, Matt. There's a very fine line with that in the NBA, and we've all seen that. And you have to have that type of positive leadership. And I think OJ, as you said, has really been trying to do that. And, there was the incident with Cousins last week. I'm not sure that contributed to that, but that's something else again. And, of course, I asked him about that in Orlando, and he didn't want to talk about that. And it was kind of funny. But he said he didn't remember what he ate for Thanksgiving, so he couldn't remember the incident after the game.
Yeah, he does have that selective memory when
he
totally forgot about his whole first season in Milwaukee.
Remember, he did that. Yeah,
I'm sure there are some other people from that season who wish they could totally forget it.
But I do think what you said. He's trying to do the right things, and the amazing thing was on Sunday he played 44 minutes. So here was his first start, and Kidd made the lineup change, and then he really rode those guys. I think he had 44 minutes for Mayo, 43 for Bayless in that game. Last night it was more balanced, correct? The box score in front of me. But
it was definitely more balanced. The bench got a little bit more of a run because those bench guys were playing well. I mean, Michael Carter-Williams had a plus 27, plus minus. Jabari Parker was plus. John Henson was plus.
The
only guy with a big plus minus in the starting lineup, even though he didn't necessarily shoot well or do a lot of big things, was O.J. Mayo, who was plus 23. Nobody else was in double digits. And so, Kidd mentioned that after the game, saying, hey, that's the stat that they look at. That's what they care about. And obviously when he's on the floor, he makes the team better and they perform better as a whole. And I think that plays into why he's a starter.
Yeah, I had a reader email me this week, Matt, you'd probably be interested in this, and said, okay, what is this plus minus thing all about? And I think it is being used more in the NBA. It's now on the official box scores. And so it's out there a little more. not that insiders in the NBA didn't use it all the time. They did. And as you said, the coaches are very aware of what that plus-minus stat is. But now, you know, that's looking. And it can be a little misleading at times. But it does show, you know, how the team is doing when a certain player is on the court. And just to define it for people, as this reader, I sent him an email back, you know, the plus-minus is what is the point differential when a certain player is on the court? Mm-hmm. You know, is your team gaining points, losing points in the minutes that you're on the court?
The Bucks' next game comes on Monday against the Portland Trail Blazers. Be sure to keep an eye out for coverage from Charles and Matt in the coming days. And that audio came to us from their Bucks podcast. You can subscribe to that on iTunes and Stitcher Radio as well. And that does it for today's show. Once again, I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned in the coming weeks as maybe we'll be staging a little bit of a Christmas production for everyone. Take care until then.